boom, clap, the sound of my heart goes beat, and on and on and on and on and on. Okay, that's me being distracted. This is Rish Outfield, and this is the Rish Outcast. And the other day, I listened to, over at Marsha Latham's podcast, he did something that was very similar to what Big and I do with our driving ruminations podcast kind of thing. And there were a couple moments where he got off track and he's like, wow, I'm distracted by driving. My mind just wanders. I can't stick to one topic. And oh, believe me, I understood what he was going through. So right now, I think this is going to be a really short one. I just wanted to say one little thing. And it's not even what I wanted to say. I was going to get in here. I was going to talk about this show that my cousin and I have been watching. It's called Hannibal, and it's based on, well, it's based on what happens before the book Red Dragon by Thomas Harris, you know, about with Hannibal Lecter and Will Graham. That's what I wanted to talk about, because every episode, it makes me wonder who the target audience for the show is and how much they can actually enjoy, how much anybody can actually enjoy a show that is so disturbingly violent. I mean, it's just, you know, they came up with the most bizarre, dark, disturbing serial killer imagery they could, thinking, well, that's what everybody remembers from Silence of the Lambs or from Red Dragon / Manhunter. And they made a show of it, but they feel like they have to top themselves every week. And it's just really repulsive, and it wallows in like how sickening the show can be. And that's what I wanted to talk about. I was going to sit down here and talk about serial killers and the mind, the disturbed mind of somebody who's imbalanced, and just, I don't know. I guess we can lay it at the feet of Brian Fuller, who has to be steering the show in that direction, where it's just like, well, there has to be at least one over-the-top, grotesque, I mean, so violent and unbalanced killing in each episode that you're not going to see on anything else, you know what I mean? And when I would watch Dexter, I kept thinking, how can there be this many serial killers in Miami, Florida? It boggled my mind, the idea that there would be that many, or that, you know, that there'd be a serial killer a season at least, and then a bunch of low-life scumbags or drug dealers or pedophiles or mutilators or whatever that Dexter Morgan would hunt down in each season. But dang it. Okay, see, this is the subject that I wanted to talk about when I sat down to drive. But then, just before I got in the car, that song, Boom Clap, jumped into my head. And I'm always I'm always behind when it comes to pop songs, because I'm old. I'm not in the target demographic anymore. You know, I'm not hearing it in the junior high commons room or wherever the fudge these songs are supposed to be heard. I guess it's probably YouTube is where songs are supposed to be heard now. I only hear these songs when they are predominant enough to play like on a mainstream station or one of those awful tween stations that plays the same song like every 2 hours they have to play it again, which I cannot stand. I can't stand it if you hear the same Pink Floyd song twice in a week. Anyway, at work I'll hear a lot of these tween-centric pop songs. And they, you know, that's not a perfect comparison, though, because at my job, you'll hear, like, the most baby-rific song. You hear Fudgin' Let It Go twice a day, once the Idina Menzel version and once the Demi Lovato version. And, yeah, I have heard Boom Clap at work, but it's the Kidz Bop version. And oh my gosh, that Kidz Bop stuff is unlistenable. Especially the fun thing is when the Kidz Bop covers a song that's inappropriate or has like an inappropriate lyric, And so, you know, they'll fudge it or they'll change something, but they're not always savvy enough to, you know. So when you hear a bunch of, I don't know, 10-year-olds singing all about that bass, and the, you know, the 40-year-old PTA president that's organizing this group and singing this song doesn't realize what the song is about. So you get a bunch of kids singing about voluptuous assholes. I don't think there's an M in that word. Voluptuous assholes. Not assholes. Oh, gosh. Sorry. Voluptuous asses. There's a difference, I think. Pardon my graphic nature. Like Brian Fuller on Hannibal. When I first heard that song, Boom Clap, Charlie XCX, I think is the name of the artist. First time I ever heard it was on Saturday Night Live. She was the musical guest and she sang it. And usually I will fast forward those. I don't really watch Saturday Night Live live anymore. Although, boy, that was a tradition for 30 years almost. And so if it's something awful, you know, if you get Jay-Z on there, I'll just fast forward the songs, the two musical numbers. But in this case, I listened to it and, you know, I gave it a chance. And about halfway through the song, I put down the remote. I was no longer tempted to fast forward it. And I thought, you know, this is really nice. And I hadn't seen the Fault in Our Stars was this, where everybody else was introduced to that song. I still haven't seen Fault in Our Stars. It seems like it was on Stars or On Demand or one of those places where I could watch it for free if I wanted to. And I just couldn't quite bring myself to do that, to watch it by myself as a grown man. But anyhow, I guess that was the love theme to that. And I heard the original version and I thought, wow, this song speaks to me. I haven't been in love in a long time, like a pathetically long time. You know, listen, guys, anything we're talking about with Rish Outfield is a pathetically long time. But I remembered that sensation, the floating, exuberant... You know what I'm talking about. I'm the one that should be asking you, what? What is that? But that song, I felt, captured that. I like that song. And yes, I've heard it a few too many times now to love it the way that I used to love it. You know, I would click through the stations and that song would be on. And I'd be like, oh yeah, crank it up. Let me pretend to know what love is. But now it's just, I've heard it too many times. Plus, once I heard the Kidz Bop version, once. All you have to do is hear that sort of thing once. It's like... I was going to go to a scatological place just then, and I decided not to. One reference to that per episode, please, sir. But, yeah, it just the Kidz Bop thing ruined it. I'm sure the song is still great, and once the rotation is over and I no longer hear it anymore, then I will feel nostalgia and pleasure when on the few times that I do hear it. But here we go. When you're hearing this, the summer is probably over or very close to over. And we'll know whether my experiment to write a novella in 90 days was successful or not. Basically, all I want to do is write Jeremiah's Blues through to the end. And if it's long, it's long. If it's short, it's short. As long as I finish that story, that's my goal for this summer, because I've already written a novel. You heard this episode already. But where we are right now in the recording of this, summer is still in high anxiety. Summer, we're still in the middle of summer. So I have plenty of time to write this thing and finish this thing. And this week I wrote out my, not really synopsis, but just a bunch of questions that I wanted to ask myself before I wrote the story. And one of them was, should there be a romantic subplot? And I still don't know. Basically, the story is this guy gets I'm going to say recruited by some city cops to be a, gosh, what would you say? Let's say special consultant. He gets to be a member of their task force. He doesn't have to go through the police academy. He's not an actual policeman. He doesn't get to carry a gun or anything. Oh, okay. It's like Castle, right? Frank Castle, the Punisher. No, there's the show Castle, and for some silly reason, which is fine, it's the conceit of the show, they allow this detective, I'm sorry, the detectives allow this mystery writer to come along as a consultant on their murder cases. And the show works fine, or at least worked fine until I stopped watching it, which was a long time before the rest of you stopped watching it. One day I'm going to go back to it. I just got old. Anyway, my character, Jeremiah, he gets pulled into this, into the police force, basically. And as it stands, without having actually written the book, it's a young woman who is... Originally, she was going to be the daughter of the police chief, but now I'm thinking she's the niece of the chief detective in a certain precinct. And she's also a cop, but she's just a... I was going to have her be like a beat cop, a uniformed police officer, but it probably works better for the story if she has just made detective. So she's got a partner. The partner initially doesn't like Jeremiah, but he will grow to. And anyhow, I felt like, okay, it's only natural for Jeremiah to develop feelings for this woman cop, for this detective. And yeah, she's not going to be played by a supermodel in my mind. She's just a woman who is strong and smart. And yeah, I'm going to go off the beaten path here and have her be compassionate. And she kind of helps him acclimatize, and she's the person he can talk to when things get difficult. And so why would he not develop romantic feelings for her? But at this point, I haven't decided whether she will reciprocate those romantic feelings. And I guess the reason for that is twofold. One, I don't think the story is about that. The story is about this outsider who gets brought into this new world and gets a chance to prove himself, and he makes a difference, and then ultimately he has to go back to the life he knew before. That was always my intention for this story back when it was a screenplay. I knew how it was going to start, and I knew how it was going to end, and I didn't know I was going to fill in any of the middle stuff. But the other reason that I am hesitant to have there be a romantic subplot is I'm not very good at that stuff. I'm not good at it at all in real life. And the amount of work that it would take to make it feel real to me, to make it feel realistic. Guys, everybody else seems to have some kind of childhood training that kicks in when it comes to romance. And they understand what to do and where to go and what to say and how to do it. And it just works for them. Now, I'm granted, everybody's got a different level of how easy it is. But I know a couple guys that romance was always easy. It's like, yeah, oh, my sister's friends would always want to make out with me or go out with me or et cetera. You know, from when I was like 13 years old, that sort of thing. And then, yeah, there are people for whom it's more difficult. There's a guy at work, and he's this little elven toad type guy. He's like 5'3". He's little. And he hits relentlessly on every single female employee that is hired. And some of them, we can say half of them, will go out with him. They don't have any interest, but he is persistent. And he has no, I don't know, maybe no sense of restraint or anything like that. He will hit relentlessly on them until they finally say, you know, I got a boyfriend in Canada, or they go out with him. And I've really learned to resent this guy, even though I shouldn't. I should look up to him because he should be a role model to me. The fact that this little guy can go out with attractive people who can do better. I mean, that should be my... That's what I want on my tombstone. He went out with girls who could frankly have done a lot better. He was successful with girls who could have done better. Anyway, with me, it's never been easy. There's this dumb girl at work, and I think I've told you, and the fact that I say dumb and girl, I guess, is two strikes against me. I shouldn't have said that. I apologize. I'm not going to edit it out because, now I want to. Anyway, just let me finish the sentence, and if I sound too horrible, then maybe I should have cut it out. There's a girl at work, and she's young, and they hired her last year, and then she went away, and then she came back. But last year, she used to follow me around at work and just talk, and I'd be doing my job, and she'd be doing nothing but just following me around. And it was a little disconcerting because I was like, wow, this is a lot of attention that she's giving me. But what was really disconcerting is how much of an oversharer she was. She would just follow me around and she would just talk about her life and about things that had happened to her. And I'd be like, do you realize that I don't really know you? You shouldn't be telling me this. She would just tell me about things, bad things that had happened or intimate things that had happened or about how her grandmother didn't care for her and always liked her sister better and went... I was just like, wow, this is really strange. She seems overly friendly with me. And oh, you know what? I did a blog post. If you ever read my blog, I did a blog post around Christmas time where she just followed me around saying, hey, look, don't ever... Gosh, what was it? I think it was like, poke me in the ribs with your fingers. Don't ever do that because it really bothers me. I'm really sensitive. So don't ever do that. And I was like, okay. And she's like, because sometimes people will do that like it's ticklish or whatever, but it's not ticklish for me. It bothers me. I don't know what it is. Maybe, you know, I had some kind of injury when I was a kid, but I'm really sensitive on the ribs. So don't ever poke me. And I said, hey, look, I won't poke you in the ribs. And a little while later, she's like, you know, I was telling you that. And, you know, it's funny that I would tell you that when, listen, if you want to poke me in the ribs, you can. Now, when that actually happened, I wrote it down in a much more humorous way because it was just bizarre. Like the third time through, she says, you can poke me if you want to. And I was just like, whoa, that is weird. So I had to blog about it because it was funny. And if you read the blog post, it's way funnier than me saying it right now, because now I'm thinking, was it really poke me in the ribs? Why would anybody say that? Maybe it was like, do the Pillsbury Doughboy poking me in the stomach thing. Please don't do that. It's like, please don't cup one of my boobs, okay? Because I'm really sensitive, you know, that. Why would you ever say that to somebody? But anyhow, I think somebody got on there and says, clearly this girl likes you if she says you can poke her in the ribs, dude. And I was like, oh, yeah, maybe that's what it is. And the evidence of her following me around and oversharing and talking like we are confidants, like we are best buds and all that stuff made me think, oh, she must really like me. So recently she was rehired and still I got these vibes from her. There's clearly an interest. And so I started trolling, if you will. I threw my lure into the water and then reeled it in to see if she would bite and, you know, talked about... I don't know. I can't do this stuff that everybody else can do. I gave it the old college try, as they say, and asked her, you know, oh, hey, what about so-and-so movie? Have you seen that? And she's like, no, I recently on Inside Out. Do you want to go see Inside Out? And she's like, oh, no, you know, and she started on this whole diatribe about her sister being upset by Inside Out and that they shouldn't make movies like that that would upset her sister. And, you know, she had thought that Disney made movies that were good, but they didn't. I was like, whoa. And so I said, okay, well, that's fine. You know, I was going to ask you if you'd go see that. but you know, like, now we can avoid that unpleasantness. She's like, oh, good, good. And I'm just like, wow, that's weird. And so, you know, I'd thrown these feelers or whatever you want to call them. No interest, no positive response at all. Oh, gosh, I forgot to tell you the one other element that makes this all the more frustrating, and it is that there was another female coworker who worked with her when she was first rehired and said, oh, she talks a lot about you. She really likes you. I said, I sort of picked up on that last year, but I didn't ever get any confirmation. She's like, well, here's some confirmation. So to have like an estrogen-fueled confirmation to my suspicions is good, is important. And still, nothing. And yeah, just the other day, she broke off from whatever work she was supposed to be doing to come bother me about some awful toy that she had seen. I guess the 60s Batman TV series has started making action figures, and she really loves the 60s Batman, which is another, it should be another red flag, that, you know. But she just kept talking about it again and again, and how long she's going to have to save up, and whether she had the self-control to not buy other stuff until she could buy this $50 set of Adam West Batman and Burt Ward Robin and, gosh, who played Batgirl? So I want to say that started with a Y. Yeah, there was a girl who played Batgirl on the show. She was lovely, I remember, but it doesn't redeem that terrible, terrible show. Anyway, it's just so strange that she'd come talk to me. And you know what? Maybe I'm in the friend zone. Maybe she sees me as somebody that she can trust, that's not going to poke her in the stomach, Pillsbury Doughboy style. But anyhow, good Lord, I got off on a tangent. The point I was trying to make is I have no idea how this romance thing works. And I have no idea in a book why a savvy, single, 20-something or 30-something policewoman would have any interest in a big oaf like Jeremiah. Even if, you know, he's handsome and broad-shouldered from working on a farm and he's got muscles and all that stuff. I have no idea. It is completely foreign and alien to me how the two of them could get together. And so, yeah, I'm sort of leaning against having them have a romantic entanglement. And, but yeah, where I stand now, I think he'll probably just develop some kind of crush on her, and she may see the guy as like a little brother or something like that, and want to let him down easy. And that I think I can write. But holy cow, how did I? Oh, boom, clap, the sound of my heart, the beat goes on and on and on and on and on. See, this, oh gosh, this would be perfect to have Connery come in and sing that song. Except for I probably am not going to do that. But I should put a song here. Gosh, I need to start doing stories on this podcast again. It's just too much work, though. Have you noticed that? It's all work and no play. And you know what that makes, Jack? Anyway, I will get back to you, maybe. Or maybe this will just be a short episode. Or maybe we can have a song here. But I will talk to you later. So, hey, this is Rish again. I think I've already said goodbye. But as Big would tell you, if he were here right now, don't say goodbye. Say good journey. Anyway, I just figured I ought to say one more little thing. It's a short episode. I haven't published anything in a long time. I've just been too busy with other things. Or yeah, I guess I need to make it a priority, but you know me. The last thing of any significance that I published, that I self-published, was a novella called Popcorn Movies. And I don't think I talked about it much. I mentioned it on my blog, but I don't think I've mentioned it on this show, and I know I haven't mentioned it on the Dune Steve. So let me just take 5 minutes here and talk about this piece that's out there. Part of the reason that I'm hesitant to plug it is because it's personal to me. It's sort of an intimate story. It's not exactly autobiographical, but you can read
into it what you will. The Popcorn Movies is the story of a young man who went off to California with big dreams of being a star, in this case a musician, and it didn't happen. He was unsuccessful. He sort of made a mess of his life, and eventually he comes back to his hometown, this small town in Utah, where his uncle gives him a chance at a new life. I don't know. That sounds odd. Basically, his uncle is refurbishing and about to reopen the small town movie theater, the Fruish Movie Theater, right there on Main Street in Praiseden, Utah. And he gives Don the chance to run it with him, to open it. The way he tells it is, you know, here's the chance to do something, to be somebody, to be successful. And Don's uncle has his own laundry list of failings, of times when he messed up his own life. And maybe he sees in his nephew a younger version of himself. And so Don goes there and makes a go of it. He tries to be successful in the theater business. And, if you're a person alive in 2015, you know that there's no chance that a single screen, small town movie theater could make it in this, not in this day and age. 20 years ago, it still would have been hard pressed to compete with the megaplexes. In this day and age, it's doomed. And yet, people come to this theater. And that's kind of the, I don't want to say that that's the hook of the story. But, you know, that's the question that Don has to ask, is why would people come to this theater? And the uncle says, it's all about nostalgia. I don't know, maybe I've said too much. The story doesn't have a lot of action in it. It's not really a horror story or any of that, the sort of stuff that you're used to hearing me write. All it really has to offer it is my writing and sincerity, if it's a positive. I don't know. I tried to put a lot of myself into this story, which is part of why I haven't been exuberant about sharing it. You know, California Rish is this character that I've come up with that will show up from time to time on That Gets My Goat, and he's super confident, and he's super sure that the things that he has done or said or written are all just great and brilliant and worth your time. And California Rish would say that the author put a lot of his heart in this story, and that's why you should read it. It's available on Amazon. It's available on Smashwords. And then I did an audio version that's available on audible.com. And I would, if you don't mind, like to play a little segment of that, the sample that is up there on Audible right now.
It had come time to renew Manitoban for another week, and Uncle Frank surprised Don by swapping it for, of all things, a print of National Anthem, the flick they'd shown 2 weeks before. Don told Frank that the Western was still making them money, enough to justify another week. But he told Don to trust him. Besides, the rental on a 4-week-old movie flop was practically nothing. And Frank was right. Way more people came to see National Anthem, Redux, than had done so when it was new. That made no sense. And they were regular customers. The Fruish had regulars. And they were all smiling, happy to be back, happy to have a new routine, to give Kiva their money, happy to see Don behind the candy counter. He wondered if this was what going to the movies had been like in his mother's day, or in his grandparents' era, when Jerry Fruish had sold his apple orchard so the town could watch Bugs Bunny or Abbott and Costello in luxury. Speaking of grandparents, there was his customer number one, lining up for his usual medium popcorn and Sprite. He wore an ill-fitting suit most every time he attended, which Kiva thought was extremely charming. And he always came alone. He dabbed at his wrinkled mouth with a handkerchief, watching Don and Kiva working silently behind the counter, one using the register, one filling up soda cups and popcorn buckets. Finally, he leaned in, smiling very big. "What I wouldn't give to be young and in love like you two are," he said. Dawn inhaled slowly. He hoped Kiva wouldn't be too harsh with her response. The old man was easily his favorite customer, though he couldn't really say why. Because he was first, because he was loyal, or because he was so chatty, Dawn didn't know. Kiva leaned over the counter toward the old man and said conspiratorially, "How did you know we were in love?"
"Oh, when you get to be my age, you know a lot of things. You should listen to the old people. You'd learn a great deal."
"You know, I think I'll do that. What's your name?"
Dawn had never thought to ask him his name before.
"Joe," the old man said. "I had a shop in town. Jolly Joe's."
"I'm Kiva, Joe. And this is Dawn."
"Dawn, I've met before, young miss. I'm his best customer, aren't I, Dawn?"
Dawn stepped away from the cash register and a step closer to Kiva. He could smell her hair.
"As a matter of fact, you are."
"You keep hold of this one, Dawn. She knows how to respect her elders."
"That I..." And Dawn instinctively put his arm around the girl, like they really were going out.
"That I will, sir."
The old man chuckled and started to walk away. Then he turned back and signaled Kiva over to him. He whispered something to her, and they both laughed.
"I'm right with you, Joe," she said, stepping back to Dawn's side. "You have a good night."
The second the old man was gone, Dawn took a healthy step away from Kiva. He thought he should apologize. She had said something about being religious one time, then thought better of it. So he'd put his arm around her. There was a big difference between an arm and a tongue or a palm. Instead, he asked,
"What did he say to you?" "He said not to let you get away either, because you called him sir."
Dawn felt his face reddening, but it wasn't embarrassment. It was, well, something he hadn't felt in a while. Maybe it had been so long, he couldn't remember what it was.
"Hey, Kiva," he said. "Thanks for playing along. He really is my favorite customer." "No problem. He talked to me the first night I tore tickets. He came here when they first built the Fruish, during the war. He seems kind."
Dawn almost asked, "A kind of what?" But realized what she meant. Nobody used the word kind anymore. He hoped she'd say something like, "Whenever he comes in, I'm your girlfriend." But she didn't.
It's funny. I've done a few audiobooks, and with one exception, I've always been charged with coming up with the sample myself. With the Doomerest of Terra books, I always try and find an action sequence, a fight, a battle, something with danger and swashbuckling in it. With my own stuff, I always try and find something that sets the tone, that doesn't give away too much, if not too spoilerific, if you will, but is something that's a good representative of the piece as a whole, and something also that has... I try to share one of the good parts. You know what I'm saying? I've talked about Into the Furnace, which is the novel that I wrote this year. And when I do the audio for that, the sample will be the scariest moment. The moment that is in anticipation where the mystery is about to be revealed. But of course, it would stop before that is revealed. And in this case, I chose a moment that I thought was kind of nice. It includes the girl. Her name's Kiva. Oh, isn't that an awful name? Can you imagine being saddled with that moniker? And it includes the old man, Joe. I don't know. It's a fair representation of the book, is what you just heard. Oh, and I guess I owe it to you to finish my sentence. There was one publisher that didn't like the sample that I uploaded. And their reasoning was that it did give away too much. It was something from like chapter 5. And they wanted me to give something from chapter 1 or chapter 2. I disagreed. I still disagree. The segment that I chose was really strong, and it would sell more books than the segment that they wanted me to include, which I did. I mean, I did as they said. The segment that I had created, that I had selected, was the discovery of a dead body. You know, it was just the moments leading up to the discovery of the dead body, and then, nope, there it is, dead, you know, kind of thing. It was a murder mystery, right? But they didn't want it revealed that the character is dead. You know, it's sort of a missing persons case. They didn't want me to tip the hand that that person is dead. So instead, we got a little bit about, you know, here's who you're after. This is how long they've been gone. Which is probably fine, I guess. I and here's a little bit of California-ish coming out. Nobody knows the sorrows I've seen. Nobody knows but Jesus. I don't know where that came from. Sorry. Nobody knows the book as well as the audiobook producer knows it. I used to say, except for the writer himself or herself, nobody knows the book that well. But I'm going to have to say that the guy who reads the book and then reads the book aloud and acts out all the lines and then has to edit it and go through and hear it over and over again, that guy knows the book. It just, I know that the segment with them finding the dead body was stronger than the segment about talking about a missing person. But I'm not in charge on all these things. And I understand wanting to keep spoilers at a minimum. Anyhow, I do like being an audiobook guy. I don't do it very much, partly because I have a job. I work a lot. That's not fair to say. Big Anklevich works a lot. I work fairly regularly. How's that? And so I usually can't work on audiobooks until it's fairly late at night, you know, at least 10:30 or so. And by then, after spending a whole day just being a human being, you tend to have spoken a lot, and your vocal cords aren't at their freshest, probably. So usually I can record for an hour or so before either I get too tired or my vocal cords get too tired, my voice gets too tired. You know, that's just narrating. Editing, you can do any time, although it is best if you have a quiet environment. But the problem with editing is it's so boring. It's so insanely dull that I often fall asleep. I could be wide awake. I'm totally fine. I'm not going to go to sleep for 3 or 4 more hours. And after 20 minutes of editing, you're like, oh, you know, screw it. I'll go to sleep at 9. You know, I apologize. I'm rambling, going on and on. I'm sure your job is harder. It takes way more out of you. I guess the point I was trying to say is I ought to do audiobooks more. The more I do, the more money I would make from audiobooks, obviously. And the fewer hours I would have to have at another kind of job. So I got to keep that in mind. Anyhow, I like writing and I like doing audiobooks. If you have any interest in popcorn movies, it's available there. And now I will let you go. It sounded like I let you go before, but I brought you back. So again, thank you for listening, and good night.
The Rish Outcast is presented under a Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivatives license. That license enables you to share the file with anyone, but not to charge for it or alter it. A license to kill, by the way, enables me to kill anyone I please, whenever I please. You judge which is better.
Hey, Janet.
Yes, Brad?
I've got something to say.
Uh-huh.
I really admire the... skillful way, you beat the other girls to the bride's bouquet.
Oh, bride!
The river was deep, but I swam it.
Janet!
The future is ours, so let's plan it.
Janet!
So please don't tell me to can it.
Janet!
I've one thing to say, and that's, damn it, Janet, I love you. The river was long, but I ran it.
Janet!
There's a fire in my heart, and you fan it.
Janet!
If there's one fool for you, then I am it.
Janet!
Now I've one thing to say, and that's, damn it, Janet, I love you. Here's a ring to prove that I'm no joker. There's three ways that love can grow.
Really, what are they?
That's good, bad, and mediocre.
Spell it for me.
Oh, J-A-N-E-T, I love you so.
Oh, this is nicer than Betty Monroe had.
Oh, Brad.
Now we're engaged and I'm so glad.
Oh, Brad.
That you've met Mom and you know Dad.
Oh, Brad.
I've one thing to say, and that's, oh, Brad, I'm mad for you too. Oh, Brad.
Oh, damn it.
I'm mad.
Oh, Janet.
For you.
I love you too.
There's one thing left to do.
And that's go see the man who began it.
Janet.
When we met in his science exam it.
Janet.
Made me give you the eye and then panic.
Janet.
Now I've one thing to say and that's damn it, Janet, I love you. Damn it. Janet.
Oh, Brad, I'm mad.
Damn it, Janet.
I love you.
It's not you, it's me.
The Last Exorcism. Wouldn't it be great if they said, hey, starting 2016, no more movies with exorcisms will be allowed. I'm sorry, it's the law. This is one of those shitty songs. I'll use this as the outtake, as the thing at the end of the thing. This is such a childish... infantile, terribly overplayed turd. This why you gotta be so rude. It sounds like a little baby song. And oh my gosh. And I hear that at work every single day too. But what sucks is I'll work with 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds, who, you know, people who are grandparent age. They should know better. And they sing along with it, just like, oh yay! It's like, oh, yeah, okay. This would be like my parents singing along with Raffi. You do realize that. When I was a young person. Sorry. I guess I lost track of what I was talking about. For the eighth time.